Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, I'm pleased to present to you today a special guest, a good friend of mine, Mr. Keith Baer. Keith is well known. He's a traditional flutist, a storyteller, and spends a lot of his time teaching in schools. Today, he has come to have a discussion with you. I know him as Keith Baer. He's known amongst his people as Northern Lights. And Mr. Baer, perhaps you could give your name to Mr. Jefferson in your own language.
In the language of the Nuwata, my name is O Mashiruta'a, which means the bright light that waves in the north sky. Or in English, my name is Northern Lights.
O Mashiruta'a?
Ruta'a, kind of a roll, the R.
Say it again, please.
Oa Mashi'i Ruta'a.
Oa Mashi'i Ruta'a.
Pretty close.
Northern Lights in what language?
The Nuwata, the Mandan language.
That's the Mandan language.
Yes.
I see.
Our name for ourselves is the Nuwata, the people.
The people.
Well, Mr. Jefferson, I know you have some knowledge of the Mandans. I'm sure you have many questions for Mr. Baer.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, I actually met a Mandan man in the White House, in what we didn't call it the White House in my time. We called it the President's House or the President's Mansion. But in the last days of December 1806 and early January 1807, I met one of the leaders of your nation. I called him the Wolf, but I understand that he's also known as Coyote or White Coyote or Sheheke.
Sheheke is a distant relative, yes, and he was very honored to meet you and to bring back good words and promises that were made to in the care of our people and our land, our rights. But as time went on, these things seemed to have been ignored.
Well, I'd be sorry to hear that, because I do believe that whatever the government of the United States says in its response to Indian peoples, it should keep its word. It should be faithful in its contract with Native peoples. And in fact, the Northwest Ordinance, which was passed before the Constitution was written, it was passed in 1787 by the Continental Congress under the Articles of Confederation. The Northwest Ordinance says that there shall be the utmost good faith shown towards Native peoples in all of our government's dealings with them. And I know from history that it didn't always work out that way, but there was a very special relationship between my government and the Mandan because, sir, as you surely know, my young friend Meriwether Lewis, who explored the American West on my behalf, began his ascent of the Missouri River in May of 1804, and the river closed. It would froze up on the northern Great Plains. His highway closed, and so he stopped for the winter beginning, I think, October 26th, 1804, and where he stopped was right at the base of two of your people's villages, a village on either side of the Missouri River, and this wolf, this Sheheke, came over and offered hospitality. And I believe, though, you tell me if I'm wrong, I was very glad to meet this Sheheke, and he was a remarkable man. But I think that he was, in some sense, a sub-chief. We understand through Lewis and Clark that the great chief, if there had to be one leader of the Mandan people at this time, it was a man named Posakapsehe, or Black Cat. Is that
Black
his name?
Black Cat, yes, that's true. And Black Moccasin was also another leader. When they came, we did welcome them because they had new ideas and they had things that they wanted to trade. We knew they were coming through the Moccasin Telegraph that let us know prior to their arrival that they were coming. They were coming in a good way, is what we were heard. And when they arrived, we offered them food, we offered them friendship, we offered them everything that we had because they came with a new idea and they wanted to trade, and we considered ourselves one of the best trading centers in the country at that time. Many of our neighbors from all four directions would come from the mountains and from the deserts and from the other parts of the prairies, bringing things to trade with our farmers here, our beautiful women that take care of our gardens. Our garden products were very prosperous here in the river valleys. When they would bring those things from the mountains and from their homes, they would also bring their families to meet our families, because we've been trading for generations before Lewis and Clark got here. We traded with some of the English and the French before Lewis and Clark got here, and they made us a good deal. They said, we would like to do this, we would like to help your people. And so it was an easy thing for us to accept them as friends, new friends and relatives. Some of those young men spent time with our people, more time than is recorded into their books. We've got stories that continue about some of the relationships that were going on down in that time. And then when they left us, we felt bad for them because we knew they were going into a new and maybe hostile environment beyond our relatives in what is now Montana, into the now the Idaho and towards the West Coast. As these other tribes encountered them, we knew very little about those past the Crows and Absarokas over this way. And so we wanted them to be aware of those such things and how to make trades with them, who to speak to. And it was a good thing. When they didn't return as quickly as they had thought they might, we thought perhaps they had perished there in the land. Maybe the other people they encountered didn't enjoy their company as much. And so we were kind of afraid because our relatives were with them. They had a young woman who stayed with some of my ancestors. Chief Bullseye raised a young woman named Sagagawea, and she was along on that journey. I think that helped a lot as far as encountering the other people and making a peaceful advance on their journey.
I hope you don't mind. May I ask you a few questions about what you've said? First of all, you said that you used the term moccasin telegraph. Tell us, what is that?
Moccasin telegraph is, we have runners, very good runners. So when we hear stories or we hear news that should be shared with those around us, those that are important to us, our friends and our neighbors, our allies, we will send somebody by horseback or on foot, if necessary, down the river in a bullboat made of buffalo hide, going that way. But most of the time it was by foot, and so the moccasin was our telegraph line.
So you're saying that before my young friend Mr. Lewis even arrived, the word had come from lower in the Missouri Basin up to your tribe?
Perhaps a month before he arrived with us, because one nation in what is now Nebraska, some of our relatives down there sent somebody up towards South Dakota, who sent somebody into North Dakota, who sent somebody up this way. So we were well ahead of them. Even after they arrived and spent the winter with us, some of the tools that they had made for our people, when they left here in the spring and they started their journey west, when they got out to Montana area, Idaho area, and the West Coast, some of their tools that they had made here in North Dakota were already there on the banks waiting for them.
So your people got out ahead of this exploring party.
And some of the things that we needed to trade made it available, and we showed them, this is who's coming, this is what they have. And so those items, those axes and arrowheads and knife blades made out of iron and steel, those were already out there on the coast. We used those to say, look, this is what's coming your way.
This is honest. Well, you know, our understanding when Mr. Lewis came back was, and you tell me if I've got this wrong, but that there were five villages, two of them were Mandan, three of them were what he would have called Minotauri, Hidatsa. And I know that's something of an oversimplification, but about 4,000 or 4,500 individuals, not the peak population because it had been really hurt by smallpox and war, but still a very large population center. But here's my question. He said that the Mandan were very friendly and offered corn and hospitality and said, if we eat, you'll eat, and if we don't, you won't, and so on. But he said the Hidatsa were a little less friendly and a little more skeptical of what he was doing and saying. Is that your understanding?
Yes, because some of the French traders had used a double tongue or lied to the people in some of their trading, and so they were a little more skeptical, more wary, whereas the Mandans tried to keep people a little more honest in their trading. But as they faced these new people in these new languages, you know, we did welcome them, and it was difficult to understand, but they made good words at the time.
But, you know, one of the Hidatsa leaders said to a Canadian in a rather boastful manner, if we wanted to, we could kill them all, and we could cut them down like buffalo on the prairie. And I think he said there are only two good men amongst this party, the mender of guns and the worker in iron, neither of which was Captain Lewis or Captain Clark. So it was pretty skeptical and even a little hostile. So was there tension between the Mandan and Hidatsa about how to treat these newcomers?
We needed to have our trade, our commerce, to continue. We needed their ability to help us transport our goods and to get those goods out and to bring in new things. And so the Hidatsas, like I said, they had that lesser good encounter with the French and some of the English before Lewis and Clark had arrived. So the American government made us a good promise. And so the Mandans, being the larger physically as well as socially people, we were the original people in this area. Then the Hidatsas came from the east and joined us, and then later on the Arikaras came and they joined us from the south.
So you were first at the mouth of the Heart and then the Knife River.
Yes.
And then the Hidatsa came from somewhere in the east,
in the
but
Minnesota
most recently
area.
At Devil's Lake or
yes.
someplace
yep.
in north in what's now North Dakota. And the Arikara came up from the Grand River Valley and even farther
below. South, yeah.
And they, all these three tribes, as I understand it, converged. But when the Mandan may have been first, but when they moved up to the Knife River, isn't it the case that the Hidatsa were already there?
Not as far as I know.
You were first.
Yeah, the Mandans have always been on the west side of the river. We moved that way, and then we encountered those. We knew that they were coming, and so we asked them to stay on the east side of the river.
The Hidatsa.
The Hidatsas.
So you span the river, one on one side, one on the other.
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting.
And then we started to intermarry, and then we have so much intermarriage that the Hidatsas are a part of the Mandans, and the Mandans are part of the Hidatsas, but we still have our customs, we still have our languages, we still have our rituals that are Mandan, Hidatsa, or Arikara.
I hope you don't mind all these questions. I'm intensely curious about this. Mr. Lewis said that the Mandan and Hidatsa were sort of a unit, different but very similar in language and custom, but that the Arikara were quite different, and there had been a great deal of tension between the Arikara and the Mandan and Hidatsa. Tell us about that.
Not to offend any of my relatives or friends that are out there, but you know they were often called Arigatahus, or people who take things that didn't really belong to them. But their prowess in war is one of the things that we needed. Their ability to track and to hunt and to defend were great assets to all of us, because our nations were wiped out pretty well by the smallpox, and our coming together and joining together, the affiliation of these three tribes was our way of maintaining our way of life and maintaining our strength and our sovereignty here on the prairie.
Forgive me, gentlemen, we need to take a short pause, but we'll return in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkins, and I'm your host, David Swenson, and this week we are joined by the noted Mandan artist, flutist, and storyteller, Mr. Keith Baer. And gentlemen, please continue your conversation.
Yeah, something that really intrigued me, sir, was your mention of the Indian girl. Lewis and Clark called her Sacagawea, but they had a great deal of difficulty pronouncing her name. Maybe you can clear that up for us. But what really strikes me is you said that she was a young woman among you. And let me just tell you how Lewis understood it. He may have been right or he may have been wrong, but the way he understood it was that she was actually a Shoshone girl, and that as a child she had been captured by Hidatsa raiders, by Minnetaree raiders, and brought back across the plains of Montana into the center of North Dakota. And there she had, in a sense, been adopted by the Hidatsa and had taken a Hidatsa name. They reckoned her name was Sa-ka-gar-we-a, and that it meant bird woman. Is that your understanding of her origin?
Yes. As far as the stories I've heard and understood in my life, is that she was brought back from a hunting journey. There were several people, young men and women, that were brought back. not brought back as slaves, but to keep our blood clean so we could keep our bloodlines going. When she came to us and was among our people, she was considered a Mandan. She was taken in by a family to replace a daughter who had passed over in the wintertime before that. So she took the place of that child. Many times our families, when we lose a family member, we'll take a cousin or a child, a nephew, a niece, a grandchild, and take them as to replace that child that has left this world.
How did she wind up with this Toussaint Charbonneau, whom I regard as something of a rascal?
Something of a rascal is very mild. He was not all that well liked among the Mandan Hidatsa people. He was very rude. He was pompous in his own way. He thought that he had full control of things because he was an older gentleman and we respect age. And so he used that against us, our tradition against us. It seemed to happen fairly often once the European people were among our people. They see that we have respect for age and we keep our word and we didn't have to write everything down. Well, they came in and saw it in a different way. So when this gentleman was with us, he made a bargain for this young woman. He already had a wife or two or three or five. And when he made this bargain for this young woman, he said that he would take care of her and take care of the family. So she needed somebody because her adopted father was getting up in age and he wanted somebody that would take care of her. Being an outsider from another tribe, she was having a bit of a difficult time adjusting. And so it was thought prudent to let her be with this other man from another place so that they were both a little bit ostracized. But she was the only thing that kept him here with his other wives and children. She was very well respected among the people. She was a great worker. She did wonderful things, and her beauty was quite outstanding from what I understand.
So let me go back to the Charbonneau. He came, as I understand it from the journals, he came to Mr. Lewis and said, "You're going to need horses to get over the mountains. There is a horse people out there at the base of the mountains. They're the Shoshone, and I happen to have a couple of Shoshone women. And if you hire me to be your guide or interpreter, I'll bring one or both of those women with me. And when the moment comes, we'll help you to get the horses you need, because these women come from that part of the world and they come from that tribe." Is that your understanding?
Yes, it is. The woman that he wanted to go with him, Sacagawea, was also pregnant. But she was a very hard worker. She was, you know, marvelous. And the other one was a little bit more weaker. And so when they first started out, he started with two wives, and then he had to let one come back because she just couldn't endure the journey. She was too heartbroken, too afraid to return, to go out there into, you know, how would she be accepted by her people after being supposedly defiled by another race or another people? And so some of that kept her back. When they made their journey, this young woman, Sacagawea, was great at medicine and food. And then her husband there used that language and that connection of relatives over the mountains so that he could be somebody. He said that he knew the trails and he knew the language and he knew the people. Well, actually, that was one of those other tongues flopping around there. He knew that his wife knew about those people. So he used her to dig his way into the pockets of Lewis and Clark.
Now, was this a private contract? In other words, Lewis saw it as Charbonneau making a contract with him and bringing this woman and her child. But was this also part of the strategy of the Mandan Hidatsa? I don't mean this in a negative way, but were you sending somebody with Mr. Lewis to watch what he was doing and or watch out for him?
A little bit of watching, but we wanted to make sure that he had a good journey. We were also very anxious to be rid of this man. And his ways of doing those things was very contrary to the native way of honesty and respect and honor for those around them. And he was just a liar, to put
so
it
you,
in
you,
the most blunt way.
In some sense, you got rid of him by
ourselves of,
offering
of
him to
burden.
Mr. Lewis.
Yes.
Mr. Jefferson, if I might ask you a question, I know that you receive regular reports from Mr. Lewis and Mr. Clark.
Well, would that were true. Here's what we knew. We knew when they left St. Charles, Missouri, because Lewis sent back some dispatches and they eventually found their way to Washington. We didn't really hear from him again until the winter they spent up in Dakota and amongst the Mandan and Hidatsa. And that winter, which was quite a long winter, and apparently the climate up there is brutal, they had lots of time for paperwork, and Lewis and Clark both dispatched some reports back to the United States government. They sent artifacts that had been either sold to them or given to them by the Indians that they had met. They sent maps. Clark's journal, although in a very imperfect and ungrammatical form, a version of it was sent back. They sent back some robes and peltries and even some live animals in the spring of 1805. And then Mr. Lewis sent me a personal letter, and one also to his mother, summarizing the events of the journey so far. But after that, once they left what they called Fort Mandan and went into the American West, into the wilderness, essentially, because the Mandan villages were a kind of last outpost of European civilization in the West, once they left there, we didn't hear from them again until they returned. And there was actually great consternation lest they might have perished.
Well, it brings me to my question, actually, sir, which is, were you aware of the actions of Lewis and Clark when they were with the Mandans? If so, did you endorse their behavior, or would you have changed the way they handled things?
I don't think so. Let me talk about it in two different ways. Mr. Lewis was operating under my instructions. Now, we had gone into great detail about what his attitude should be, how he should present himself, how he should present his party, and how he should present his purposes, scientific and military and commercial and legal in terms of sovereignty and so on. And I authorized the Lewis expedition before the Louisiana Purchase was consummated. Once we bought that territory from Napoleon Bonaparte, then I gave Lewis further instructions. So at first he was essentially a trade emissary and a scientist, but once the Louisiana Purchase was completed, he was also a legal representative of the United States government. And here's, in a very short compass, what I wanted him to say, and I'd be very interested for Mr. Baird to respond, but I wanted him to say first, we come in peace. We're not a war party. We have no interest in hostility. Number two, we're not traders. You know, we have these big boats, and you may think there might be merchandise in them, but not really. This is a scientific expedition, and we have a very long way to go, and we can't be selling off much of what we own, but we do have some small items as tokens of future trade, which leads to the third point. They said to the native peoples they met, you know, we'd like you to trade with us, with merchants from St. Louis, with Americans. You can continue trading with British and French and Spanish if you want, but we hope you won't, because we can offer you better prices and better goods more reliably in the long run, and we're a little edgy about continuing commercial relations with the Canadians. And number four, they said to them, and this was especially true of the Hidatsa, stop all this war and skirmishing and so on, all these raids. You know, you go every year, you raid out into the Blackfeet and into the Atsina and into the Crow and into the Shoshone, and you capture a few people or kill a few people and steal some horses, and then they come back and they counter-raid, and it's war and it's tragedy. This is silly. You've got to have peace. And if you will only agree to live in peace, then the United States government will secure it. Well, you can live under the security umbrella of the United States government. But this warfare, this is really upsetting to the idea of trade and peace and enlightenment. And then finally, and in the long run, most importantly, but in the short run, not, Mr. Lewis said, we aren't here to buy a single acre of land. This is your land. We acknowledge that. This is your land. We're not here to buy anything. We have bought first option, you know, in buying the Louisiana Purchase. If you ever want to sell us a portion of Montana or a portion of Wyoming or South Dakota, we have first right. You can't sell it to the French. You can't sell it to the Russians. You can't sell it to the Spanish. If you want to treat with a government from now on, it's with us and nobody else. But we're not here to tell you where to live or how many acres or how to have your economy. But we do really urge you to live in greater peace with your neighbors. So is that your culture's memory of what Mr. Lewis said?
Those were the words that were offered. Those were the words that were offered. And when we heard those words, we thought, well, this sounds like a good deal for all the people along the way. It sounds like a very good deal for our commerce and our stature among other trading peoples who came to us as their commerce center. And so we accepted that. And when they left here on their journey and they encountered the other tribes, they had a few difficult moments. But when they came back, we were so happy to see them once again. We sang songs, you know, sang honor songs. We sang songs of rejuvenation and life again. Welcomed them back because some of them had left children behind. And so they were our relatives in that way. And even today, that some of those people are still among us. When they wanted that land, they said, well, you trade with us first, and then you give us first option. Well, what happened? Because we were supposed to talk to them when we were going to make a trade. They made trades. They cut down the land. They took away so many things that they had promised before they even came to us and asked us, well, we're going to make your reservation smaller. We're going to take some of this land away from you, some of that belongs to other people. Well, they had promised this to us, and they made these decisions without talking to us. And so there was our first slap in the face from the United States government, who had just made us good words. And this also hurt the feelings of some of those leaders, Lewis and Clark, who had valiantly stood up for us and said that we were a good people. We were a people to trade with, an understanding people. Some of the other tribes they encountered weren't as friendly. They knew that the Mandans had the respect of those other people because they came here to trade. Our relatives that were out there along the journey as Lewis and Clark made their way that way, they also said, oh yeah, those are my relatives back there. Here, stay with us. Here, this is someone you should listen to. And then seeing Sacagawea with them was also an invite to say, this is not a war party. These guys seem to be coming here in trade. So they opened their ears, but over time, those words were forgotten. Those pieces of paper maybe have been thrown away or lost somewhere. But we know in our hearts, we know in our words that were handed down word by word. They turned their back upon the people. They brought us terrible things, you know. Every time they wanted to make a trade, they would bring alcohol, something that we had never had before.
That certainly wasn't true of Mr. Lewis.
Some of those people, when they sat down, they make you feel real good with that thing. And then when they leave that stuff behind, and that poisoned our people. So that was something we had never encountered before, and that has been a detriment to our people ever since. You know, that was a difficult thing. The Europeans had it for thousands of years. We've only had it for the last 200. So dealing with that was very, very difficult, and still is to this day. Understanding that they had the government backing them and saying, we're going to do this, we will be honest with you, but they made so many decisions before they were. And I don't know if they really have been honest with us ever since. You know, those were the first words that came out. And they said, this is how it will be. But it never was. They made decisions well before they came to us.
Keith, let me ask you a question. You've got a much different perspective on this. And you speak of these stories as if they were yesterday. How do you know all of these things? How did you learn all of these things?
I'm very fortunate to be born into the family of the Little Owls. My mother was a Little Owl, and they were, and still are, people well respected for their ways of medicine, ways of recording history, ways of dealing with people. Some of our other relatives who lived long into their years, one of the last Mandans was Matthew Grinnell, my great-great-grandmother, and she told stories of such things. My grandfather on my father's side lived to be 98 years old. His grandmother was niece of Sitting Bull when he returned. So having all of these stories so close at hand in our family.
So you're saying it's an oral tradition.
It's an oral tradition.
History
that, yeah,
these
so
stories
that we keep
down.
These things passed
down.
Right.
I don't know how that would work. Maybe you can explain it, but in my culture, we have an alphabet and we have written records, and that's the only way we can remember what happened in the past, because we're very document-centered people, and we understand stories. Every family has its stories and so on. But for reliability of historical and legal records, we write them down and bind them up and put them in repositories. But that's not how it works with you. How can you count on these stories?
Because we, a lot of times, recorded them in our hides, on the winter count hides that came, and we put in there things that were very important, things that would be affecting us in the future, things that happened this winter that's going to affect our great-grandchildren. Those were the things, and we keep telling that story over and over. And so many of the stories that I carry today and many of our relatives carry today are almost verbatim of the stories that Lewis and Clark heard. So our oral history is very important to us. The things that we used, canes with markings on them, spears with markings on them, lodges with markings on them, clothing with markings on them, everything told a story. And so that was our way of communicating, writing things down, picturesque.
One other thing, Mr. Bera, if you could explain to the president, he talked earlier about the brutal weather that exists, especially the winter weather.
43 degrees below zero, Mr.
And,
Lewis said.
Quite perhaps you could explain to him your dwellings and how they were built and how they protected you. I don't know if Mr. Jefferson is aware of that or not.
Well, these are not teepees, as I understand it.
No, these are earth lodges. These lodges are made out of cottonwood trees and ash trees covered with 2 or 3 feet of dirt on top of willow boughs and grass that have been laid over that. In the summertime, they are very cool. They are moderated, the heat inside and the coolness is moderated by placing the door in such a way, the hide over the door and over the smoke hole opening in the top of that lodge, there would be a bull boat or something laid there to control the air that passed through. In the wintertime, with this thick walls, 2-3 feet on the bottom, 4 feet, and then 2-3 feet on the top, it was very, very warm. You could walk around with no shirt on the inside of that lodge. But as we saw these lodges, and we had plenty of time to talk and to write these things down, whereas a lot of the other tribes that lived in the teepees and the much thinner, they had to struggle to survive, and they didn't have much time to sit down and draw and paint and do the things that we did.
Mr. Jefferson, they are marvelous structures, and you should see one.
Well, I've heard that they're a little bit like igloos, but or I think one of the Canadian traders said they're like molehills. They're almost caves, but they're mounded. Is that correct?
They look like small hills, a whole bunch of small hills when you see them from a distance. Look like blistered ground. But when you get there, those lodges could be maybe 40 feet across on the inside.
We've actually received an invitation, Mr. Jefferson, from an author, a Mr. Potter, who would like you to come and visit him at an Earth Lodge, if you would be so willing.
Well, it's a very, very long way from Monticello.
Well, he has agreed to...
It took Mr. Lewis, you know, almost a year to get here.
Mr. Potter has agreed to make arrangements for your travel, sir.
Well, I would be eager to see this. I've always, of course, wanted to see the American West. I never traveled across the Appalachian Mountains. I was always on the Atlantic coast all of my life.
Well, gentlemen, we need to take a short pause. We'll return in just a moment, and when we do, we'll be speaking with the man who portrays Thomas Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson, and our special guest, Mr. Keith Bear. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me now, however, is Mr. Clay Jenkinson and Mr. Keith Bear. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. David Swenson, the host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Here we are in Bismarck, North Dakota. And I just want to say to our audience, you know, I pretend to be Thomas Jefferson, but Keith Bear is Keith Bear, Mandan, Lakota, Assiniboine, and what else?
Mandan, Hidatsa. Assiniboine Sioux from Fort Peck.
Assiniboine Sioux?
Yes.
Not Lakota?
Right. It's a Dakota up here.
Yeah. And so, but do you primarily consider yourself a Mandan?
Yes, I was raised by my mother's people. My father passed on when I was quite young, and we started in Montana. And after his passing, we lived with my relatives in North Dakota. I was still continued to raise by my father's sister, Norma, and my aunt, Iva. And then my mother, being a Mandan Hidatsa, I was raised by many of our relatives. My grandfathers, my aunties and uncles, some of them wanted to teach me how to be a cowboy, some of them wanted to teach me how to be a dancer and a singer and carry on some of our traditions, some of these holy traditions that we have.
Well, Jefferson was so fascinated by Native peoples. You know, it's a weirdness about Jefferson. Probably no American president, and that includes all of them, was more interested in Native American lifestyles, dwelling styles, economy, quill work, bead work, music, culture than Jefferson. Jefferson was the Enlightenment was fascinated with Indians because the Enlightenment, you know, these Europeans from France and Scotland and England and to a certain extent Germany and Italy were stepping back and asking questions. You know, were all people born in the Garden of Eden? Are Indians part of this? Are they different? Are they Asians? How'd they get here?
Yeah, we've had some discussions in the past couple of weeks about this, and I have come to this conclusion that part of that fascination, now you can tell me if you think this is right or wrong, but I think part of that fascination with the people of the Enlightenment and Native peoples was their absolute freedom. As we said, the free Americans, the Native Americans, they had a level of freedom that Europeans could not achieve because of their culture. Do you think that's accurate?
Yes, and I apologize to Keith in advance for what I'm going to say, but I'm going to try to characterize how they saw things in Jefferson's time. People like Thomas Jefferson looked on Indians, and they used the term Indians then almost exclusively, but they looked upon Indians as ourselves without opera and literacy and cities and legal system.
So unpolished.
Rousseau created the term noble savage, and he
right.
didn't mean barbarian or something. He meant noble dweller of the woods, that Indians were sort of innocents that were untouched by the tragedy of Western European civilization. And so they were freer, and they were healthier physically, and that they were healthier spiritually, and that their governments were voluntary. They didn't have kings, and they didn't have tyrants, and they didn't have feudal landlords, and so on. That there was this kind of wonderful wilderness innocence to Indians. And to be sure, these people saw them as primitive. They didn't have metallurgy, they didn't have alphabets, and so on. But they admired Indians because Indians were sort of ourselves if we were still free. And that was the glory.
Right.
Ourselves if we were still free. And of all the Indians that Jefferson ever met, Jefferson was really fascinated by this. He took down Indian vocabularies. He met Indian delegations. He read about Native cultures. And he didn't really have any contact with Indians living in their actual villages. That's a problem. But he had these emissaries like Zebulon Pike and Meriwether Lewis. And Jefferson's view was that of all the Indians in America, the ones that were most remarkable, most interesting, that he most wanted to understand were the Mandan. Which is kind of interesting, but here's why. And then I'll turn it back to Keith because, of course, a lot of what I'm about to say is just nonsense. But the Enlightenment believed that the Mandan were maybe Welsh. I mean, there was this whole weird thing where the Mandan were lighter skinned and they had some gray hair and even some blonde hair and they had some blue eyes and so on. And Europeans were sort of looking for the lost tribe of Welshmen. Madoc had apparently come to the New World in the 12th century and so on. And there was this kind of quest. It's like a Don Quixote quest for where are the Welsh Indians? And they finally decided they must be the Mandan. And because of that, everyone loved the Mandan. And they all said, oh, they're more intelligent than their neighbors, and they're more decent, and they're more civil, and they're cleaner, and they're friendlier, and they have these great Welsh characteristics. They're Indians, to be sure, but they're Welsh Indians. And Jefferson was slightly a part of this myth. But Keith, you can take it from there. Apparently, this isn't true.
No. See, we also encountered some of those Vikings who came over exploring this way. You know, they spent time with the people. They bred with the people, too. Like you said, the 12th century, when Prince Madoc came over here, he did come up the river. And maybe there was some intermingling among the people who gave us such characteristics. And even today, my daughters have patches of blonde hair on the backs of their heads. My son has it. Some of my relatives have this characteristic of a patch of blonde hair or different color eyes. We're not sure if that's from Prince Madoc or not. But I did have the opportunity to go to Wales and to stand in the very same church where Prince Madoc stood
really?
Before he came on.
When was this? Tell us that story.
That was a few years back. I went to an international storytelling festival there in Pontydarwy, Wales, and Swansea, Wales. I went all over the country. Had a great time seeing these old, very old buildings and houses. I stayed in a home that was built in the 15th century, kind of a Charles Dickens looking thing. It was just fantastic. But some of those people were very fascinated that I was Mandan, and they could tell me things that were just so interesting about Prince Madoc and their relatives who were part of Prince Madoc's excursion this way. So having the opportunity to stand there and to see from the very same pulpit, from the very same church, and to look out and see the very same ground that he left behind coming over here was still a very fascinating, wonderful, warm moment for me with those people.
But wonderful.
We are a very separate people, the Mandan and the Herats. Our language is unique. A couple of the things that scholars look at is some of our words are exactly the same as the words of the Welsh people. Maybe that was an influence from that time of our encountering them. Some of our structures of our homes, the roundness of them, the roofs of them, theirs were made of stone and trees. Ours were made of raw wood and dirt because we don't have a lot of stone up here. We don't have a lot of trees either. And then as they encountered the people, our boats are very similar to theirs. We have buffalo hides wrapped around willow branches. They had a conical woven boat, round little thing, and that was quite
interesting. Welsh bull boat.
Yeah, so you know, we have things that are in common, but we also have things that we have from the Norwegians who came over this way. Maybe some of that comes from them. Some of the first stones that were found here in North Dakota, here in North America, came from the Viking or over in that Danish part of the world. You know, so they came from the south and they came from the east and they came here to North Dakota. They came here to the Mandan and Herats, and they were welcomed and they were shared with and glorified. And we still try to keep them in our stories to say that, you know, we are a part of those people and they are a part of us because, you know, we have two legs like they do, like any other man. We have two eyes, but just like them and their nations at home, we also have one heart, which is true to this earth.
And of course, it stands to reason in a certain way that if the Mandan have always been here or here for many, many, many centuries, and this is an international trade center in North America, people are going to be passing through and there is going to be mingling of genetic stock and blood. And so it's not at all unusual to think that the Welsh may have intermingled, that early Vikings may have intermingled, certainly recently Germans, Czechs, Bohemians, etc.
Well, as we understand it, Madoc's encounter with the Mandans was his second journey to this land.
Really?
His first journey took him up the Ohio and Tennessee area in those rivers, and they tried to subjugate the people at that time. But the Indians surrounded them and said, you either go home or you starve there in the middle of that river. And so he chose to take his people back. But a few years later, about 5 years later, he made another journey this way and came up the Missouri River. And that's where we think the encountering the Mandans and Welsh people came from that.
Well, you know, our listeners have probably never heard this before. So you can go to Google or Wikipedia and look up Madoc, M-A-D-O-C, and Welsh Indians and John Evans. And there's a whole, it's an interesting subject, and we should go on another time about this. But let me go back and ask you a really hard question, and I certainly mean no offense. But if I do say something offending, just tell me. But you know, it goes back to this idea of the noble savage, this Rousseauian, Jeffersonian idea of kind of idealizing Indians and saying, oh, they can do no wrong. They're freer than we are. They're more beautiful. They're more healthy. Their relations are more individualistic. They're what humans are supposed to be. And as you know, today in the early 21st century, there are many different attitudes towards Native peoples. One of them is racism. There's a lot of racism in Indian country. There's also indifference, which is even worse, I think, you know, just two worlds, almost apartheid. Indians live in their world, white people live in their world, no mingling. But then there is also this kind of noble savage strain, which we saw during the Lewis and Clark bicentennial, of white people fascinated and admiring and just, you can see the reverence in their eyes when you play your music or tell stories, or the great Amy Mossett of North Dakota or Gerard Baker. What's that? I mean, does that bug you that white people have this, in some ways, have this kind of lingering, uncritical, complete admiration for your culture?
It is kind of frustrating at times. You know, they can't believe that we live in a modern house. You know, they can't believe we drive cars, and you know, they think there's a fence around the reservation. They, you know, think we all get a check every month. You know, we don't. You know, it's a very difficult life that we live. We were promised many things by the government, but we still have to make our own way every day. The things that were promised were health care and education. You know, we have a very difficult time, but fortunately, our Mandan people stress education. So we have been some of the leaders among the Native people of this whole country for many, many years. They've respected our songs and our ways of intermingling and carrying on our traditions. And so I'm very, very proud to be a Mandan Hidatsa. I'm also proud to be a Dakota related to other people up that way. And I'm part French also, you know, so I look forward to going to France again and maybe perhaps meeting some of my relatives there, because I'm looking into history to find out who that trader was up there in the Montana area who my ancestors married into.
Keith, could you share with our listeners some of the, you're a great artist. You've traveled the world. You have a number of CDs released. You work in schools. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that and let people know just what it is that you do?
I try to bring an awareness, a cultural understanding that many people refer to the Native people as Native Americans. You know, I grew up being called an Indian, and I'm very proud of that because I'm an American Indian, you know, that puts the land first. Some of our people here in North Dakota are German American, Irish American, Spanish American, African American. They put their other homeland first. But see, we as Native people have always looked at the land first, and so I'm very proud of that fact. When I go into these schools, sometimes I hear these children say some terrible things. And they heard this from their families, and some of those families are pretty ignorant to have never encountered an Indian, to have never spent any time on a reservation or gone through there. They stereotype us way too much, and so it's difficult. But then if I have the opportunity to talk to these children, to come in dressed in my Native clothes, to catch their attention right off the bat, because they're all fascinated with the feathers and the leather and the bows and everything, you know, that I bring in, and the stories that I encounter with the flutes, enhanced with the flutes, that flute mellows their hearts and their minds, and it opens them up a little bit.
Now, you so actually teach kids how to make flutes.
Yeah, I teach them how to make flutes. We do beadwork, teach them the music, sometimes a little dance to it, language, counting, singing in our different languages. And I ask them, how many of you can speak your own language? You know, how many of you know where your ancestors came from? Some of them don't even know their great-grandparents. You know, their families, European families, are separated after marriage. You know, you're out there on your own. They come to your wedding, give you a bunch of gifts, and say, see you later. Whereas Native Indian people, we get together, and the married couple usually gives gifts to those attending to say, help me when I need help. Watch over my children when I'm not around. And so it's still a community thing. It's still everybody's included, not excluded in our families.
Well, I know I've talked to you about this and heard some of the stories, and I think let me be the one to say that I know you have changed the lives of many students during the programs and presentations that you make. And you have a great new CD out, Morningstar Whispered, and we'll put some information on the website if anybody is interested.
This is a combination of traditional stories and contemporary stories and some older music and more contemporary music.
And it
music.
Was done in connection with the North Dakota Council on the Arts, I believe.
Yes, it was. I've thanked Troy Geist very much and all the people in the offices there for giving me the opportunity
but
and helping
you're
us.
You're continuing to do performances in school. I know you just came from Concordia College.
Speaking with some of the advisors who will be talking to the new students this year on vocation and career choices, using the stories of our people as don't force somebody into one situation. Let them explore this and let them explore that, because you may have something in mind now because your parents or somebody else does it, but it may not quite fit you. So try this a little bit for a while. Try that a little bit for a while until you find your niche in this life.
Let me, if I may, just slightly change the subject. Jefferson was a man of the 18th century, and he had certain attitudes. Some American Indians today just can't deal with Jefferson and say he set in motion the chaos of the 19th century. Others look upon him more favorably. How do you think, how do you assess someone like Jefferson, deeply curious and yet an imperialist too?
Yes, he may have been, but we chose him and to follow his word as a leader of the people. And the people among our natives choose a leader by their honesty, by what they can do to help all those less fortunate around them. And so he introduced himself as a great father, William Clark, and them said, this is a great father from Washington. So we understood that as being a grandfather, a family member. And so we respected that. And to have them come out and say, our great father wants this to happen, we thought, this is a good man. You know, we need to listen to him.
Gentlemen, I hate to interrupt, but we've run out of time this week. Keith, thanks so much for coming in. You've been one of the pleasures of my life has been to know you, sir, and I appreciate
the time
spent. What an
honor to have you here today. Thank you.
I'm very humbled and honored to have both of you gentlemen as my friends.
And we'll post some thoughts about books to read about the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara and the history of white-Indian relations in North Dakota on our website, jeffersonhour.org.
And then also, we must mention, I asked Mr. Jefferson if he would accept the invitation to visit an Earth Lodge. It sounded like perhaps he would.
Next week's program, I think, is going to be an encounter between President Jefferson and Tracy Potter. He's going to be talking about his book on Shaheka, White Coyote. I hope I'm getting that right.
Shaheka Shoat.
Yeah. And how, you know, Shaheka went to Washington, D.C. to meet Jefferson, but the government of the United States had an extremely difficult time getting him back. And it's a long, interesting story.
Well, maybe we can get into that next week. But I think the interesting thing is that Mr. Jefferson will be at an Earth Lodge, and that's where the show will be.
Not in the barn,
but in the Earth Lodge.
And I've been in those Earth Lodges. I've never been in an actual Earth Lodge that's being dwelled in. Have you, Keith?
Yes, I have. If you'd like to come to Fort Berthold, I have several relatives. The Spotted Bears down in Twin Buttes area have one that is furnished quite nicely.
It's a date.
All right.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And with that, we'll say goodbye.
Take care.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Broadcasting and brought to you by the New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. If you would like to obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 1-888-828-2853. Again, that number, 1-888-828-2853. The program is also available online at www.jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you would like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the show, visit the website. Again, that's www.jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.